My name's Elijah Manor, if you weren't here before. I'm not Elijah Wood, even though I share his name. However, I am short like a Frodo or whatever those people are. today we're going to be talking about HTML5 and CSS3. That's a very large topic, if you've ever dove into it. And as of late, really almost forever, the boundaries of what that really means have kind of been blurred. And so some of the things that technically aren't in the specification for HTML5 are being called HTML5. And so we're going to basically try to fly by cover most of the things that you hear that's encompassed in that. Again, I'm Elijah Manor. That's kind of small. Sorry about that. I'm an MVP, work for a company named Apintu, and I'll have this up later. You can contact me. So what is HTML5? Now, this is the new logo that was put out, and it's comprised of a lot of different things. These stand for, like, semantics, device access, like geolocation type things, multimedia, like video, audio, performance. There's web workers to make things fast, because JavaScript's single-threaded, so like only one script could be running at a time. And so web workers, we'll talk about how to do better than that. Offline storage, we'll be talking about connectivity and some graphic stuff, and then CSS3. As we go along, we'll be talking about browser support and what if certain versions of IE or older browsers don't have support. What can you do to still have a similar experience? So these six icons, or no, eight, really boil down to all these different technologies. I don't expect you to read it. It's just kind of like, blah. Like, we can't cover all that in 60 minutes. And if we did, it would just be very superficial. And if you look at the bottom, it says, and more. Like, there's more things I couldn't fit on this without making the font extremely small. So the main thing we want to know is, out of all these hundreds of features, who supports what? Is it in Firefox? And if so, which versions? You got Safari and Opera. You might not think a lot about Opera, but it's huge in the mobile industry. Like, it's like the number one browser. Like, you would think iPhone or something like that, but no. If you think globally, actually Opera is really big. IE, multiple versions, 9 and 10 are really promising, but we still have to deal with, what if your company wants IE6 but still wants to do fancy stuff. You got Chrome. Don't have to worry much about that as much because it updates in the background. So people tend to have newer versions without even thinking about it. And then who never knows what's up next? Maybe Facebook will make a browser. I don't know. And that would be sad, and we'd have to support it. Hopefully my Wi-Fi, oh my goodness, what is wrong here? Ah, here we go, much better. So there is a nice website called the HTML5 and CSS3 Readiness, and this is fancy, like semicircle. It's a way to visualize the support across browsers. So here we have color codes of different browsers and versions. And then we have features, like content editable. That's something where if you put it on a div, and put content editable, you could actually go in and put your cursor in a div and actually update it real time, and then come out. It's like an editor, a real time editor. And so, surprisingly, IE has had that forever. Actually, they came up with that, and so then other browsers like, well, that's a good idea. We better support it because people like it. But you'll notice some of these columns are much smaller, like SVG filters. The smallest one being indexed. DB database. It's kind of like a CouchDB, MongoDB type database in the browser. So we got various support. It's just a nice visualization. Not a really good place to maybe go and get hard facts, but from a large landscape, it's a nice place to go. But then you have to think about, that was just desktop browsers. What about mobile browsers? It's becoming more fashionable these days to make websites on the mobile device that seem kind of native. Like, maybe can't access all the native features, but people expect a richer experience. And so then you have to think about the what features does BlackBerry have by native and Android, and it's just a huge mess, and it can be very overwhelming. So when you first come at developing a website, you need to first think how you're going to approach developing a website. And once you figure that out, figuring out what you need to support is a little bit easier. So these days, graceful degradation is one way to look at developing a website. So first you say, well, my developers love the new stuff, so we're going to develop our website using all the latest and greatest technologies. We're going to assume they have IE 10, well, maybe not anything that's released, maybe IE 10, 9, Chrome, whatever, I think it's up to 50. I'm joking, but it goes up so quick. I think they're in 15 right now. Anyway, you just assume that, you build for that, and if browsers don't support that feature, you kind of have a lesser experience. It still works, but maybe it doesn't look as nice. So that's one way to approach it, and you want to make sure it doesn't break, like it just gracefully degrades. Another way to look at development of a site is you start developing for like the stupidest browser, like that doesn't have a lot of capabilities. You make sure it works there, and then you layer on top of it code that makes it smart and look better. The end result of these two, they kind of meet in the middle, but it's just a mindset of where you start. In either of those cases, you tend to use something, you tend to use a polyfill. So a polyfill, it's a term that was kind of, well, it's a real term, but it was kind of made up for our field, but think of, like, if you have cracks in your wall, like you want to get some plaster and you want to polyfill it. You want to, you know, push in the cracks and make it look like it's, you know, a nice solid wall. And so a polyfill is a library that mimics what the actual specification should do. So, for example, later we'll be talking about geolocation. Well, that's a specification. Technically not HTML5, but it's been kind of rolled into that term. So what someone will do is they'll write an API that looks exactly like what a modern browser would have, with the same API calls, the same method names, everything's the same. But if that browser doesn't have the real version of geolocation, it will use this library instead. And the library is smart. It'll say, first it'll check, does this browser have the coolest, the real version? And if it does, it'll just say, well, use that instead. Don't use mine, because mine's probably slower and not as fast. So it's a way to kind of fill in those gaps. And there's a tool called Modernizer, which helps you detect these features so you could handle them intelligently. We'll look into that a little bit more, too. There's also something, a new term being thrown around you might have heard. It's called Taffy. And Nicholas Zakas came up with this, and Paul Irish had a blog about it, and it's basically the concept of I wouldn't watch like a black and white TV show on my HD 3D TV. Like basically kind of target features, and it's okay if something doesn't look as good on a different device that doesn't have those features. And so he came up with this nice picture. I mean, this would be silly to have the same experience on, like, the latest TV as you would, like, your great-grandparents. Well, maybe not great-grandparents. That would be a radio or something. But and so that seems kind of silly. So a visual picture like this puts it into perspective that it's okay that if your website doesn't look the greatest on an old browser. And I think clients are starting to understand this more and more, because if you come to them and you say, well, it's going to be an extra, you know, 40 hours of work to get this one feature to work and maybe IE7, whereas if we could assume a certain feature set, then you just have it for free. So, unfortunately, people are starting to, when it comes down to money, it makes a little more sense. So you might be wondering, how do I start? Like, there's so many things, and the support is so broad. How do I even start? So first, let's look at the semantics. And semantics just means when you look at your code or elements, that they have meaning. So instead of just having divs like everywhere, like div, nested divs, which is people used to use tables for layout, and that's very brittle, and so they just went over the board to all these divs, and it just, of course, you could put classes on them and IDs, but it just became a mess and hard to make sense of. So, so this is the way you used to probably develop, where you'd have this crazy long doc type, and there's like, I don't know, 8 or 10 of them to choose from. Am I using the right one? I don't know. And then you got all this weird, like, HTTP equiv, like, what does that even mean? And then you're like, well, of course I'm using type CSS. What else is there? Like, there's all this extra junk. Of course, there used to be VBScript, but no one uses that anymore. But so anyway, it's just kind of cluttered. And so what it looks like now is just a lot simpler. It's more just more terse, and in this case, it's not more descriptive, but for your doc type is really simple. It's just like it's HTML, and that means it's HTML5. For the style, you don't have to say it's CSS anymore. It's just that's the default. If you want something else, you can put it in there. Of course, there's nothing else people use. And the same thing for script. It defaults to JavaScript, and so that makes a lot of sense. So it cleans it up a little bit. And now there's not that equiv set thing. It's just, here's my car set, UTF-8. So what the committee did is they researched, like, millions of websites, like, you know, through an engine that just interrogated all these websites and got statistics on what IDs were they using, what class names were they using. And then they basically exposed that data. And so I took that and I made a chart. And so if you can see up here, footer, it was obviously the biggest class name. I mean, a lot of websites have a footer, and they tend to use the class name footer. So like, hey, I bet that's a new tag. So now there's a footer tag. There's not a menu tag, but it's now nav, so it's essentially a menu. And so they kind of look through, and you'll see MSO normal, which is actually the output of, like, Office. Like, if you say export this document to a web page or something, that gets littered everywhere across the internet. But you'll notice header is a really common class name as well. So they took this data, and they're just trying to figure out how are people already using the web. Why can't I? Can't change my slides. Here we go. So then they did the same thing with ID names, and a lot of the same concepts applies. People, a lot of people have the ID of footer, menu, nav, etc. So they took that information, and now we have all these new tags. Actually, it's a little bit harder to read than it is on my screen. But we have footer, header, nav, sections, articles, aside. That's kind of like something, it's not necessarily a sidebar, but maybe information that's not necessarily directed to what you're looking at. Captions, video, audio, a lot of stuff. We're not going to look at each one of these necessarily, but it's good to know they exist, and it takes a little bit of research to know how to use them appropriately. But the thing to note for cross-browser support, especially old versions of IE, if you start using these and apply CSS styles to them, it won't work. Like, the browser's like, I don't know what that is, so I'm not going to style it. So you have to do some tricks to actually get old ones to work. And there is HTML5 shiv that you can get that Remy Sharp made. It's a very simple script file. It essentially just news up elements with these names and make sure they're of a block type. And once you do that, then the browser says, oh, okay, I know what this is, I can style it. So if you want to support older browsers with these tags, it's not too hard. There was a problem if you tried to insert HTML5 elements dynamically, like with jQuery or something. That would break, even with this shim. And so another guy made InnerShiv, which is the intent of that is to help that process to dynamically put HTML5 elements in your DOM. Thankfully, with jQuery 1.7, which is RC2, it should be released probably within this month, I would imagine. It handles that for you now, so you don't have to have this special library. But you'd still need the shim. either the shim or use modernizer, which we'll talk about over and over again. It also does that internally. It's a tool to help you detect which features a browser has and allow you to do something intelligent. So HTML5 forms got a big upgrade as well. Because kind of thing, so HTML5, the intent of it is to see what people are already doing and make it easier. Either agree, like that's the way people do things, so we're going to add a spec around it so there's not ambiguity. Like, you know, how should one browser do it versus another? So it's a very long spec, but very detailed. So to make sure that each browser does it the same way, so there's not questions. But they also saw people wanting to do regular expression validation. Everyone's adding autofocus to certain fields, just very common things that you have to do anyway manually, and it's a pain in the neck sometimes. And so they were trying to make it really easy. So let's quickly, there's this nice, Chris Coyer, he works for Woofoo. They do a lot of forms on the web. And he spent a lot of time looking at each feature of HTML5 forms, looking at all the browsers and figuring out the inconsistencies and everything. And he made this nice test page that exercises all these and shows if this browser supports it or not. And the cool thing, the screen jumped down to the autofocus because, hey, it's actually doing the job of what you used to have to write JavaScript for. And all he had to do for that was, probably shouldn't have done that. He just added autofocus attribute to the input, and it just magically works. And so all of the HTML5 form stuff is like that. You just add like a little attribute. But you got cool things like placeholders. Let me zoom in here. And so if you want to help them know what to type in, like an example, like this might look like an email address. And just to give them a little bit hint of what to do, that's nice. Max length is on text areas actually used to not work, so now it does. If you wanted a numeric field that has a minimum number, like you could only go down to a certain number and can't go any further, and you could actually use your arrows up and down, but you can't go any further. Just common things that you probably had to do anyway. Like if you want a file chooser that to say I want to allow them to select multiple images but match a certain regular expression so they can only do maybe PNGs and JPEGs, then you could do that now. You could say that something's required, so you can't say submit without filling it in. It'll actually pop up a little bubble and says, hey, this is required. And you don't have to wire up any of that JavaScript at all. You could put patterns in like regular expressions. There's really lots of stuff. You could turn off spell check, which is maybe nice if, you know, it wouldn't make a lot of sense to spell check a email address or something like that. So anyway, it's we're not going to go into all those, but there's a lot of new stuff around that, which is really cool. The next thing we'll look at is offline storage. And there's something called application cache. And I'm on a project now, and a client of mine won a jQuery mobile site so drug reps could go to doctors and visit them in areas that don't have a network connection. And they want to be able to know where their appointments are. They want to get into it, make notes, record, you know, what things they've, what drugs they used and talked about. Work all offline. And then when they happen to get back in a cell connection, it will sync with the server. So you're like, wow. And at one point, one of the guys, I guess he wasn't up to speed, and he was like, we were putting some screenshots to show him what it might look like. He's like, well, I would think that would be a 404 error. And I was like, well, no. There's this new spec, application cache. And what it does is you define, at your HTML tag, you give it a file. And it's just a manifest file, which basically says, in this file, you could find all my assets. Everything that this website needs is listed in this file. And it's just a text file. So I say, you know, it has to start with cache manifest at the top. And I say, I want these things cached. And you just list all the files that you know that you have to have. like maybe, you know, a starting page, a home page, a detail page. And then you list things that you never want to use the cache, like maybe it's an API call, etc., or an image that you always want that to do the freshest data. Of course, those won't work if you're offline, but you want to tell it, even if you're online, I want you to use the newest stuff. And then you have a fallback section, which is kind of cool. Let's say you have a bunch of images that are dynamic from the server. And when you're offline, if it sees a page, instead of giving it the dynamic image, which it hasn't cached, you can tell it to always replace it with like maybe a question mark for the image or something clever. But it would always use that as a fallback. You could have fallback versions of dynamic pages as well. So you basically define everything in here. And anytime, so what will happen, the first time you go to the web page, it'll look at this manifest file. It'll say, do I have it? Have I downloaded it? No, I will go to this manifest, grab only those files that I told you about, have them internally, and even if you're online, it will use those ones it's downloaded. So you don't have to go back and get those again. The only thing it does every time you refresh is it just pings that cache manifest file and says, has that file changed? No, keep using what I have. Has that file changed? No, keep using what I have. So it's a very small hit. And really, when I say it has a change, it's not the date, it's not anything, it's just any content in this file has even a white space. Have they changed the white space? So that's what this version thing's in here for. It's nothing magic, but I tend to just bump up that number or maybe put the date of when you last changed it, and it will look at this file and then pull everything else. So keep in mind, if you have this manifest set and you're changing your JavaScript, no one's going to see updates until you change this version or make some change to this file. So that's important to know. There's an API around all this that you could use in JavaScript to actually tell what it's doing, because it checks that manifest file. And so you can look at the status. There's like an uncached status, an idle status. It's checking status. It's downloading the new file status. And it's ready. It's ready to be updated. Now, it won't automatically, it pulls them automatically, but it doesn't flush the cache and reload the page. Like, it waits till the next refresh. It doesn't force it on you. So what you could write JavaScript to say, okay, well, it is ready, so I want to update it. I want to swap the cache out. And then you could, like, prompt them, hey, there's a new version. Do you want to load it now or wait till later? Anyway, and there's all these events that you could listen to, etc. So it's really powerful, and it's been fun to play with. So that's one thing. That's static data. Now, this offline app I'm talking about, they were able to input real data. That needs to be stored somewhere because eventually I need to send that data back to the server to actually save it. One way you could do that is to use web storage. I actually use something else. We'll talk about that later. But web storage is you can kind of think of it as like a cookie on steroids. Cookies are bad. If you eat them, you get fat. Cookies are fat because every time you make a request to the server, you're sending the cookie to the server. It's sending it back. It really bloats your request. So, and a lot of people don't realize that, unfortunately. And when they do, they're like, oh, that's not good. So web storage, which is, there's a local storage and session storage. It's very easy. It's just a key value pair. You just say, you just set the item. I want to set first name, and I want to give it a value. The thing about this API is there's multiple ways to do it. You could always call set item with a key and the value, but you could just say window.localstorage.yourkey. As long as your key doesn't have special characters that JavaScript doesn't allow, you could just say dot first name. And it will shove that in there. And if you're familiar with JavaScript enough, you know that this syntax is the same as this syntax. This is just the same way to do something. So that's how you do that. And to retrieve it, you just give it the key, either calling getItem or using the syntax, and you get the value back. You could remove it, and you can clear everything. So this is a brief example. So we can call setItem. Set item, and I'm just calling length to get here, and I'm going to This might be kind of brave with me. Probably shouldn't do this. I'll learn in a second. So I closed the tab. I reopened it. I still have two things stored. So it still remembered that I have things. So if I go and retrieve it, I should get the same bag. Now, that's local storage. It has the same security things as cookies. It has to be the same domain, yada, yada. But then there's session storage. So some people are like, well, I don't really want it to persist across a whole browser shutdown and reload. So a session storage keeps data within that tab's session. So if I close that tab, it would lose session storage, which is good because there were some issues back in the day about tab sharing information. But yeah, it's specific to a tab. So if you close it, it loses session storage. But the API is the exact same. All these ways, it's just instead of saying local, you just put session storage. And you could say set item and all these things. So another way to do offline persistence is there's something called a Web SQL database. And it's basically it's essentially SQLite in your browser. And you might think that's a ridiculous idea. But there are use cases for it, like if you're working offline. So this is what we actually do, because the local storage, it's hard to actually, there's no way to search and tell, you know, this is the date I last do intelligent queries about what data should I send back, and it could get pretty complex. And so what we actually do is when the client's online, we pull the data down, put it in this SQL database so that they can work offline and still interact with the data. And then when it goes to sync, we query our internal database and say, okay, what's changed since the last sync with the server, get that information and send it back. So this is a brief example. This is going from Twitter grabbing all HTML5 hashtags. I previously loaded 100. Since the last time I uploaded, there have been 35 new ones, so it just pulled those down, shoved it in the database, and now I could query my internal database to look for certain words, and then it just spits them out. I mean, it's nothing rocket science. I can't even read these, but it could be of use. Unfortunately, the sad thing about this spec is it's been deprecated. since this is a kind of a living spec, they're not necessarily going to kill it, because it has a really good adoption story across mobile devices and desktop devices. And so a lot of people are using it. They've kind of put an ixnay on the whole SQL database, mainly because for them to support it, they wanted to have vendors implement it in a different way other than SQLite. Because currently all the implementers of browsers have always used SQLite in the back end. And they said, well, we're not going to continue with this until some browser implements it differently. I don't know. I guess that sort of makes sense. But to make sure the spec is not specific to a certain technology. So anyway, we used it for our mobile device because mobile browsers tend to have it. If it really goes away, we'll probably switch to a different technique. The newest, if you remember that semicircle we showed at the beginning, the thing with the least amount of support was IndexedDB. And it's, I don't know if you've been listening to the whole relational database versus, you know, index database like CouchDB and stuff. But this is essentially CouchDB or MongoDB or RavenDB in the browser. So you just have a data store, and instead of having relational tables and keys and foreign keys, you just say, here's my information, store it. And then you just retrieve it, and it's already serialized and all that for you. I'm not really going to go into it too much, but it's kind of complicated. But that's coming, and if you like that type of thing, it will be here soon. So device access. Browsers, especially, want access to your phone. Like, you know, I really want access to my geolocation. And so they kind of expose that through the API. And it's not too bad to support. It's actually very easy for geolocation. There's something, a navigator, which is in the global namespace, so window.navigator, and it has a geolocation. So first I'm checking, does this browser support geolocation? Because if this was null or undefined or all those falsy values, it wouldn't get in here. So if it's defined, get in here and say, get my current position. And you pass that a callback because it's async. And so it goes and tries to figure out the connection. Gets it back, and you have this really nice object with your longitude, latitude. So I just called it now. It gives you a timestamp at the time that you retrieved it. And so my longitude is 4.43. My speed is null. So not all devices will tell you those things. Like maybe if I ran across the room. Chrome doesn't actually do that. But that might be something on a mobile device. You tell me which direction I'm going and my altitude and all that stuff. So it's actually pretty easy to use. Oh, and there's... probably can't see that, but there's something I didn't know existed. There's a watch position as well. So instead of calling just get current position, there's a watch position, and that will you open a connection and it will give you real time information when your position has changed. So I don't have to keep calling get current position. It'll just keep calling your callback when it's changed, which is kind of cool. And then you could clear it when you want it to stop doing that. Now, if an older browser, if you wanted to support this, an older browser doesn't have geolocation. There are many polyfills, like I mentioned before, you're filling those holes. And it's actually a pretty easy one to do because there are many web surfaces out there. You could just call them, and they might figure it out by your IP address, you know, essentially kind of where you're at. There's actually a really good GitHub. On the Modernizer website, there's a page that lists like probably like 100 polyfills for all the different various technologies. I'll try to show that near the end. There is a tilt orientation. So MacBooks have a tilt monitor, and so does your phone. And so I could actually tap in to how I'm tilting my laptop, and I could change the UI accordingly. So I have three images, various opacities. And if you look at the numbers at top, they're changing. And then I'm just moving them according. I'm changing their top and width. I've never used this in production, but it seems really cool. So WebSockets. So this has gotten a lot of popularity these days. So what a lot of websites will do is... they'll just continue to poll the server for new information. They'll have some timer, like every 15 seconds, do I have anything new on the server? Let me go check. And it uses HTTP protocol, which if you do that a lot, it's just kind of bloated. You know, it's not really a good way to do that. And then people start to get a little smart and like, well, if we set our timeout really big, we could open a connection and just hold it and do long polling. And wait, and when the server, you have to do some special coding, but if the server sees something, it could send the information, which closes the connection, and then the client opens another really long connection. And that drains the battery, especially on mobile devices. It's not bad on the web, but a lot of chat clients are done that way, long polling. It just keeps it open. But you have to do hacks, and it's just not natural. It was kind of an afterthought, and they're like, hey, we could be tricky. So WebSockets was kind of answers some of that, but it actually uses a different protocol, like a WebSocket protocol, WS. But once you've opened it, you subscribe to a lot of these events, like on open, on air, on message. So you just create a new one, and then it will let you know when it's opened, and then you can start sending stuff to that socket, the information. So you have to do special stuff on the back end. It's not just a front end thing to support this, but libraries are making it more easy to do this. So this is a two-way street. I could send stuff to the server, or the server could send stuff to me. It's just an open connection. But it's not using HTTP. It's not bloated. It's just like, here's some data. You know, just raw data, boom, boom, boom. So it could be really fast. But then again, what about older browsers? I thought I had those. There are a couple libraries that will actually even support, that fall back to using Flash to do some of that sending data back and forth. It's slower to load up, like because the Flash has to, you know, instantiate itself, and it's kind of slow. But if you want it to really work, I think it even works back to i6, which is pretty impressive. But the cool thing about it is you write all the code assuming it's the new version, and it just works either way. There's another technology called server sent events. And so this still uses the HTTP protocol, but it's one way only. Like, I open a connection, and only the server sends stuff to me. I don't send it to the server. So think of maybe a stock ticker where, you know, I'm not going to send something to, Wall Street. They send stuff to me. And so this allows you to easily bind to events. So I create a new... So again, I'm checking, is this feature supported? Meaning is it not null or undefined or all those fallacy values? If it is supported, then I new up a new event source, passing it some endpoint. If it doesn't, then I could maybe use long polling or just a normal polling. It would be slower and not as cool, but you can still do that. And then you just bind some events to that source, like a message. Anytime the server sends a message, it'll come in here and you can do something. Anytime it's opened or there's an error. So it's a lot simpler because it's only a one-way street. I can't go back. To support this, what am I doing here? Sorry, I keep freaking out. Okay, so for the server, it sends a content type of text/event string. And that's how the browser knows, oh, this is a special thing. And then the data that you send back, these first two are optional. You just really need to send data and pass some string. This is actually JSON, so it'll serialize it. JavaScript on the way back. But the retry, you could. So this is actually smarter than WebSockets, because WebSockets, if something goes wrong, you have to reopen a connection and worry about all these things. But the server sent events, like if it's been over 3 seconds and it hasn't, it's been dead, it will try to kick itself back up again. So there's a lot more intelligence behind this spec. But you could define, like, I want it to be longer than 3 seconds or less than 3 seconds. You can actually associate an ID, which is kind of cool, because let's assume you're getting all these stock information. You're associating an ID with it, and let's say the connection went down, and then you went back up. If data got... It kind of reassures that you don't get the same data twice. At least you don't see it, which is cool, because that's a real problem. And you could actually send more than one piece of data at once. So this is an example of data I'm sending back. So I just have data, which is just random data, but I could say it's a special event type, like, hey, this is a stock update. And NASDAQ is at 2740. And so then you would source bind to that type. And so only that piece of information, this little piece right here, gets shoved here. And then we could have a crash event, the stock market crash or something. And you give it a date, and should I worry is true. And then that information will only get into this event listener as the type of crash. Hopefully that doesn't happen. But if it did, it would go there. So that's kind of cool. Let's go to multimedia. So audio and video are pretty big, and you probably heard a lot about that. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of agreement of what types people want to support. Each browser kind of makes their own decisions. I'm not sure the rationale for them all, but it leaves the hard work up to you, because if you want to be cross-browser, if you want to support cross-browsers, you have to support a lot of different types. So like OGG, MP3, Waves are all different audio types that, if you look at the spectrum of browsers, not all of them support. So the good thing is you put these in here, and if it doesn't support any of these, you could have maybe an object tag with a Flash fallback. And if that doesn't even work, you could show this text. And it kind of goes top down, like it tries to find the first one that works. There's a lot of cool attributes, like you could auto-preload it, the information if you want, instead of when they click play. You could show controls or not, if they could play and pause. You could autoplay so it starts immediately. which is usually kind of annoying for people. Actually, when I was doing one of my slides, it had autoplay, and of course it was on another slide, but it had loaded, and I was hearing it, and it was really annoying. So, don't do that. There's a loop, so if it gets to the end, it'll just keep going around, which is kind of nice. Auto buffers, which is kind of similar to preload, but if it's muted, and there's cross-origin if it's on a different server. But so it's pretty cool. So here's a neat demo of using the audio tech. I don't know. Actually, I think there's a cord somewhere. This is my only slide that has audio. So you just build up your own track, so different instruments, and you know when they should show up, and like how loud they are, intensity, and it's just a site just to play around with audio. But it's using just little snippets of audio and splicing them together with JavaScript to load them up at the right times. Because the cool thing about this spec, let me stop those, is. You can interact with it with JavaScript as well. So if I created an object literal and grabbed the element, and I'm grabbing it with jQuery here and grabbing the actual DOM element, I could call the element.play to play it and the element.pause to pause it, and you can mute it, and you can do a lot of things. You can control all that with JavaScript. And so there's a very nice coupling there that you could declare it very semantically and then also play it with JavaScript and your own technologies. The same thing applies for video. So the API is actually very similar. You have a play and a pause, just like I mentioned before. And a lot of these attributes are very similar. Autoplay, controls, loop, auto buffer. The main difference is width and height, obviously. It'll use what it could figure out, but you could change it. But it has a poster, which is nice. So if you don't want the first frame to show, you could give it an image to show as the first frame instead. And then when you play, it'll actually just play the video. That's annoying. One annoying thing, like if I upload to YouTube, of course now they have like a little picker, but a long time ago they just picked something. I'm like, that's totally not what I wanted. And unfortunately with video, you have the same problem about the types. MP4, there's WebM and AUG and all these different things. And so the work, unfortunately, is on you to make this cross-browser. And then you can still do a flash fallback and then show text if it doesn't work. There's something called Vidly, V-I-D.L-Y. And if you don't mind your videos being hosted somewhere, you could upload one format of your video to this service, and it will actually generate all the various iterations, and it'll give you a nice script just to point to that, and it'll figure out the right version to use, which is really nice. There's something called popcorn.js, which is really cool, and I might use it with the video that's taken from this, but it allows you to have a nice JavaScript API to basically add events at certain times in a video or audio, so you could respond to those. And so what I'd want to use that is grab the audio of this talk in JavaScript, put certain times which I know I changed my slides, and then listen to those and then react to it, and then like, because this is all web-based. So you would be looking at the real web version, and it would automatically switch the slides for you. Because obviously audio is a lot smaller than a huge video download. So it's some clever ways to maybe do things. Or if you have a training site or video, it maybe could tap into the audio and navigate for you. Just some nice creative ways to do things. This is I think it's cool. It's actually a bunny. No, that's not the cool part, but if you like bunnies, it is. Come on. Oh, there you go. So this is actually a video, but it's being displayed on a canvas, which is something we'll talk about later. But we could actually blow up this video, because it's actually just a canvas painting the video on this drawing area. And so I could interact with it however I want. And it's really showing. The cool thing about HTML5 is, okay, I need to turn that video off. is all the pieces work together. Like I could style video things. I could transform it. I could, with some of the CSS3 stuff, I could rotate videos. I could add like a mirror to the bottom, like some of the Web 2.0 sites do. So you could really interplay a lot of these elements together, which is great. And you can use Canvas and JavaScript. And it's not just, boom, here's a video. It's a lot more than that. Okay, now we're on to 3D stuff and graphics. Now, SVG has been around for a long time. It's only now that a spec has said, okay, it's been around. Now we're going to add an official spec around it so that anyone who implements it needs to do it in a standard way. It is markup. Like, you write this language to draw shapes and do really fancy things and markup XML. It's vector-based, so if I zoomed in really far, it would still look crisp, and if it came out, it would look fine. So zooming is really great. It maintains a DOM, just like the web page, since it's... if I want to move, if I have multiple shapes and I want to move them around, it's really easy to do, as opposed to Canvas or WebGL, which you have to repaint everything again. Every change, you have to repaint stuff. It's like every little pixel you have to manipulate. But if it maintains a DOM, you don't have to worry about all that. You just sort of move it, and it remembers the rest and redraws it. And it can change dynamically. There's a nice... I'm not a big SVG guy, so there's this nice editor, and you could you draw and do all this fancy stuff. Of course, it's not working for me right now. This is awesome. Why is it so slow? We might have to skip this demo. It's probably how I would design SVG, because it does it for me. Okay, well, I'll skip that. Sorry about it. So Canvas, like I said, is totally different. It's bitmap output. So you are controlling every pixel on the screen. And it's not DOM. You can't just move things around. But there's a lot of power behind that, because you could grab an image. Like, this is an example where I grab an element on the page. I new up an image, give it a source locally. And then I could just, once you define a canvas, so Canvas looks like this. It's just a tag with an ID with a width and a height. There's nothing smart about it. It's just, here's an area on your screen. Go for it. You can do what you want. And so there's a bunch of APIs to draw things and do circles and arcs and all this fancy stuff. But it's just a lot of power. But it could take a while. But fortunately, there's libraries to smooth that out. But so what I could do is I could grab this image, take the canvas context, and just say draw image. And I could tell it exactly what X and Y coordinate to shove the image at, and it just draws it like normal. And if, again, this is Modernizer, which is that library that detects what a browser supports. So I would first check, does this browser support Canvas? If it does, do this. If it doesn't, maybe do something else, like just show them an image. Like, don't do anything fancy. Or maybe use Flash to support that. You know, maybe it's a little bit more bloated or slow, but do something intelligent. So you could do some of those things. This is a Canvas example. I don't know how much code this is, but it's like a little sticky bag, and I could like throw it around, and it's really kind of useless, but it's actually really fun. But to know it's dynamic, it has all these options, like how sticky it is. Like, oh, it's not very sticky. So you could like, boing. It's like, and then they're like, hey, it's really stiff. Like, it can't really move around as much. So how much? Yeah, it's kind of silly, but it just shows you, like, that's a very interactive thing. But sorry. oh, you better get away from that. Okay. So WebGL, if we go back a couple slides, when we got our element, our canvas element, we said get context, and we said 2D. So canvas is basically 2D animations. So when we go to, you could think of WebGL as kind of like canvas, but it's 3D. So you still have a canvas. Here's an area to draw. And you give it width and height. But now when we say get context, I think it should say 3D. That doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, there's something called experimental-webgl, which is essentially 3D canvas. And so this is the first real like website that wasn't just like, wow, that's a cool canvas effect. Like someone actually used it, I don't know, I wouldn't say for good, but so it's a gallery, you could pick a character. Maybe I shouldn't have picked that one, I don't know. And then you can switch to 3D. And so then it's loading modules to handle like the 3D drawings. And then you could like move it around, and I don't know, I thought it was kind of clever. But anyway, you could do some really interactive things. That's all in the browser. This is not like those 3D QuickTime things. Like this is drawing on the screen real time. Maybe it's not a real use case. I don't know. I have yet to find to use that in production either. So, okay, so here's something you might be interested in. I was talking to some people earlier today, and they're just talking about the performance of JavaScript on the browser, and we're pushing more and more onto the browser. But the more cool stuff and animations, the slower sometimes the response time is. Or maybe I'm doing some heavy computation, and my animation's quirking out on me or not updating in time. So there's a new spec for web workers. And it's essentially, now JavaScript is single-threaded environment, meaning only one script could run at one time. Now, behind the scenes, it might do however it wants. Like, maybe it's really spinning up threads. Who knows? The operating system, browser, et cetera. But when it comes down to it, when it runs, only one script can run at a time. So that has led into problems. And clever developers who don't want their website to seem slow, they'll do things like set timeout or set interval or some things to basically redistribute what's going to be ran. Now, it's still ran in a single-threaded approach. But when it comes down to it, you're not parallel processing. You're just making things async and running a slightly little bit later. So Web Workers tries to solve that by actually you kick off a new worker. Like, I want a lot of work done in JavaScript, so I'm going to pass it off to somebody. And then I'm going to bind to that worker and say, okay, let me know when you're done. So send me a message. And then, I grab the worker and I post a message that says, hello, worker. And so here's my worker script. And all it does is it listens to the message that was posted from the caller. And it, imagine heavy computation here. You know, I should have put a comment. So it's doing a lot of work, but it's not affecting the UI thread. Or I say UI thread. It's not affecting the UI responsiveness. So it's doing a lot of computation. And behind the scenes, I don't know. Maybe this is really a thread. I don't know. But and then when it's done, it could post a message back or even to update. It doesn't have to be done. But these could talk to each other back and forth through messages. And so that's a nice way to free up some of your responsiveness so the user doesn't feel like things are slow. Well, why did I just... Okay. So now we're going to move to CSS. We don't have a lot of time left, unfortunately. But a big thing you should know is there are a billion... Well, not a bit. There's four. A lot of prefixes, because each browser doesn't want to just use a new CSS3 feature, because each one might be doing it wrong, possibly. So they're trying to wait till it's finalized before they just say transition is really the way it's going to be. So you'll see WebKit does it one way, so like Chrome and Safari. Mozilla, like Firefox, does it a different way. Microsoft and Opera. And so the technique that people do today is if you want to have a transition, use CSS3 transition, you start with all the browser prefixed ones first, and then the real one last. And so what eventually happens, in CSS, whatever's last wins. And so the intent is when the real one comes out and all these are phased away, this code will still work because it defaulted to the real one. So it's slightly annoying because it bloats your CSS to death. There are nice tools. Wow, that does not show up at all. Let me see if I can... There's a CSS3 please site, and you can hardly see it. That's awesome. But it has a lot of the common features that you would do in CSS3, like here's some gradients that you cannot see. But I could toggle it on or off, and it applies it to this this fancy, crazy thing. But you could set like alpha channels and rotate it and add transitions and then you just say to clipboard and it copies all the crazy code. Because this also includes Microsoft filters. Because there's some things, and filters are totally made up by Microsoft, but there's some things that you can't do in CSS with old versions of Microsoft, but they had this thing that they made called filters. And so you could actually do some of these intelligent things that we just have, and the syntax is crazy. So this is a nice website to help you out a little bit. There's something called font face. So if you want to have a different font that the user doesn't have, there hasn't been a very good way to do that. But now there's a font face. So you basically define a new font using this @ font face. You give it a font family name, which is what you'll use later when you use your font family. So whatever the name I define, I'll use it here. So this is Action Man Regular. And then, unfortunately, like audio and video, browsers haven't really figured out one format. So yet again, the work's on you, yay, to have all these different types, like WAFs and TFFs and EOTs and SVGs and a bunch of TLAs. So that kind of stinks, but it's cool, because then you can do, like, Spider-Man. What in the world? Oh, someone made this Twitter account for me that I didn't know. They put my face on Spider-Man. And I forgot when I clicked on it, it goes there. And so I didn't know. I kept getting these tweets, and I'm like, who is doing this? So then my friend told me. It was kind of funny. I thought it was funny. But did I? I think I just closed my presentation. That is awesome. I did. Okay. I'll open it back. It's lead, see? It's hacker. If you know that, you're awesome. If you're not, it's okay. Okay, where are we? Ooh, we did that one. If he caused the problem, he's like webbing me. Okay. So media queries is something, responsive design is a pretty new thing. Actually, the talk right after me in the building across the way is all about this, so I'm not going to go into it too much, but the idea is there's so many different size screens. Like there's little screens, and there's horizontal screens, and there's tablet screens, and there's like a billion different sizes of phones and tablets, and it really stinks to have the same look and feel on all of them. So wouldn't it be nice if you could have pretty much the same code, but it looked different and feel different? Yes, that would be cool. So what you could do, there are, in your CSS, you could say, here's media, and it says four screens that have a max width of 1024 pixels. Use these styles. But if you're screen has max width of 720 pixels, like the really small screen. Let's make it maybe one column. So let's, you know, remove the floating things and just make it, and everything has 100% width, so just make it a one column site. So that's kind of neat. So one website that did this, a lot of websites are doing, but the Boston Globe. So if you were on the web page, it's very, a lot of things, a lot of widgets everywhere, but if you had it on a tablet, then it's just two columns, and if you have it on a phone, it's just that single layout, and it feels really nice, and it looks really nice on each apparatus. Obviously, there's a lot more to this, and there's a whole talk about it, but you'll see more and more websites doing this because there's so many different types of devices that people could use. And you could tap into if it's a landscape or a portrait and react accordingly. This is my last. I'm 2 minutes over, but this is my last thing. If all this fails, like if you're down to it and your client really needs IE7 or 6 to do all this crazy awesome stuff, and you don't want to spend like a month to support it, There's something called Chrome Frame, and Chrome made it, and Chrome made it mainly to address ICE 6, because it's just not, unfortunately, it's not going away. Like, it should, but it's not. And people have whole websites about you should die and stuff, but it's not. It just doesn't listen. And so there's something called Chrome Frame, and it basically takes the Chrome engine and makes it the rendering engine of IE 6 and 7 and whatever version. It uses that instead. And so you can actually put code in your web page to prompt them, hey, do you want to upgrade? Or at the top in your meta tag, you could say, if you have it installed, use it to kind of suggest for it. Because if you don't do that, it won't natively, it's not going to force everything to use it, but you could opt in, which is nice. But you could actually also encourage people to use it as well. A project I was on recently, they had a code editor like to change the layouts and CSS, and unfortunately the code editors that we were using worked great in all the modern browsers, but IE7 had this weird thing, and we're like, should we spend the time to try to figure out this library that we didn't write, that we were hoping it would just work? Or do we say to our client, do you mind if that version of IE, we do this? You know, it's a trade-off. So, but just know that exists, because that could save you a lot of time and effort.